This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The inmate who died in the Macomb County Jail was there because he couldn't pay a traffic ticket. And that sounds an awful lot like the old concept of debtor's prison. All across Michigan and the rest of the country, people are being jailed over failing to repay fines or fees. But debtor's prisons were banned by the federal government in 1833. And then in 1983, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down a unanimous decision in Bearden versus Georgia. The court stated that putting people in jail simply because they can't afford to pay a fine is unconstitutional. It violates their rights under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. So why are people still getting caught in the vicious cycle of debtor's prison? Eli Hager is with us now. He's a University of Michigan graduate, and he's with the Marshall Project. It's a nonprofit, nonpartisan news organization that covers America's criminal justice system. Good to have you on the program today, Eli.
Good to be here.
You've researched the history of debtors' prisons in the U.S. How far back do they go?
Oh, they go back just about to the origins of the country. The original debtors' prisons were brick-and-mortar facilities that were intended exclusively to hold debtors, people who were in debt. And they were kind of modeled off of London's old-world debtors' prisons like the clink, which is the origin of our expression, in the clink. Mm. And so they go back to the early 1700s when we were just beginning to imprison people for all kinds of crimes.
And that makes sense. I mean, I read my Dickens and Victor Hugo, so I know that was just part of the culture. People in that era wouldn't even bat an eye at the idea of throwing someone behind bars over a debt?
Right, exactly. But in America, it increasingly seemed old world and feudal because a lot of immigrants had come to America to escape debt. In America, people did begin to bat an eye.
When did things begin to change in America about debtors' prisons?
Well, in the late 1700s, people started to have that view. And then around the War of 1812, which was a very costly war, a lot of people ended up in debt. And as more and more people became indebted, they were objecting to debtors' imprisonment. And then, as you said, in 1833, the whole concept was banned under federal law.
Is this how, in part, that bankruptcy laws came about that we have?
Exactly. I mean, bankruptcy laws, there have been several stages of bankruptcy law, but beginning in that same era, bankruptcy law began, and the concept was that lenders, too, should share some of the risk in a loan transaction, and it shouldn't just be the debtors who end up going to jail or taking the whole cost of the bad transaction.
How did judges and other judicial bodies react to challenges to that ban on jailing someone over a debt?
They upheld it very consistently. The Supreme Court on three separate occasions has said that if you're indigent, you should not be put in jail for being in debt because that violates your 14th Amendment protections.
Yeah, why did that Bearden case in the 80s get to the Supreme Court? Had there been some change in public perception?
No, it was just it's something that was sneakily happening all along, the debtors going to prison. And this, the Supreme Court just repeatedly had to reaffirm the unconstitutionality of putting someone in jail who is too indigent to pay his or her debt.
All right. So here we are, Eli. We're talking about the death of a man in the Macomb County Jail who was there for 30 days because he couldn't pay a $772 fine for a careless driving conviction. Why are we having that conversation?
I think the return of debtors' imprisonment has kind of happened in stages also. It began with the normalization of incarceration that we've been talking about lately as we talk more and more about mass incarceration. So in the 70s and 80s, putting somebody in jail for a low-level crime became more and more normal, and debt was one of those crimes, including low-level drug crimes and other types of crimes that we've been talking about. So more and more laws and statutes were passed in states that allowed jail terms for the non-payment of debt. And then you saw the kind of next stage in the early and mid-2000s. A lot of states were facing budget crises, and they were kind of using those laws to fill their coffers with traffic tickets and court fees and fines to deal with their budget mess. And then kind of the third stage is we've seen a growth of this offender-funded justice system in which private probation companies have grown up in a number of states, particularly southern states, and they charge the criminal offenders themselves for all kinds of things, ranging from drug testing to public defender fees to court fees to fines, even to the costs of incarceration for room and board for being in jail. And so making offenders pay all of that themselves has led to all of this debt.
And you stop and you think about this idea of this pay or stay sentencing, or people who are, you know, already in the criminal system having all of these extra fees piled on. And you got to say, how does throwing someone behind bars help get that thing repaid?
People do say that, exactly. And Several times it's been shown that the cost of incarcerating someone is often much higher than the amount of money to be gained by actually getting the traffic ticket or the fine or the fee.
What's the incentive for jurisdictions or municipalities to fine people who are not in a position to pay?
I'm not sure that there is much of an incentive, but judges like to take hardline stances sometimes on these things. And when they see somebody who has come into court and just not paid something over and over again, even if they have reason to believe that that person is indigent, it kind of is just a stance that judges take. They say you're obstructing justice, you're in contempt of court, you're disobeying a court order because you're not paying.
You did point out in the article that you wrote for the Marshall Project about debtors' prison, part of the problem is that the Supreme Court didn't quite define a couple of key terms.
In that Bearden decision from 1983 that you mentioned, They said that judges are actually allowed to throw somebody in jail if they're willfully not paying the debt, as in they're doing it on purpose, or they can pay the debt, but they're just not doing it. But they can't throw the debtor in prison if the debtor is indigent. But in that decision, they didn't exactly define those two words, willful and indigent. So judges make that determination on their own. So they can say that somebody is willfully not paying a debt because, say, he came into court in a flashy jacket, or he has expensive tattoos on his body, or he hasn't quit smoking, so why is he spending all that money on packs of cigarettes instead of on the debt? So judges can say that all of those are indicators that it's a willful non-payment of the debt, even if they have other reasons to believe that the debtor is actually indigent.
So here we have, for example, an example that you point out in your article, a woman in Illinois jailed because of an unpaid medical bill. Are we muddling the line between public and private debt and criminal and civil?
We certainly are. There's two different ways to end up in jail because of your debt. There's private debt, for example, if you're in credit card debt or if you've not paid a medical bill like that woman in Illinois, or if you have a late car payment, or if you took out a loan from a predatory lender, like a payday lender, and you haven't paid it back. Any of those lenders, those private lenders, can now take you to civil court, and they can file suit against you in civil court. And then if you don't show up for civil court, or if you fail to respond to the action, the judge can throw you in jail, not for the nonpayment itself, but for something like contempt of court or disobeying a court order or failing to appear.
And aha, now we're criminal.
Right, exactly. So now it becomes criminal. And another thing to note is that you have no right to counsel, right to an attorney, when you're in civil court, even though you can face those criminal consequences like going to jail. So you don't get an attorney as you would if you were facing criminal charges, but you do face criminal consequences.
So where do we go from here? Are there some states, are there some regions and counties that are finding new and better ways to address this issue?
I don't know that there has been that much action, but I know that in Alabama, Missouri, even Louisiana, there have been several lawsuits challenging this practice. A lawyer who is taken on a number of these lawsuits is named Alec Karakatsinis, and he's actually won several lawsuits in Alabama and Louisiana challenging debtors' imprisonment, and several counties in those states have actually had to stop jailing people who were, you know, in debt or behind on payments. If something like that happens to you, if you find yourself in jail because of not paying a traffic ticket or a medical bill, know that you do have the right to file suit against your state government.
Eli Hager is with the Marshall Project. It's a nonprofit, nonpartisan news organization that covers America's criminal justice system. Eli, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.